This is Joe Mowat, the general manager at Eastern Municipal Water District, and you are listening to the Water Values Podcast.
The Water Values Podcast is sponsored by the following market-leading companies and organizations: by 1898 & Co., Possibilities, Powered by Experience; by Woodard & Curran, high-quality consulting engineering, science, and operations services; by Intera, innovation and stewardship for a sustainable tomorrow; by Xylem, let's solve water; by the American Water Works Association, dedicated to the world's most important resource; by Black & Veatch, building a world of difference; by 120 Water, new rules need new tools; and by Advanced Drainage Systems, our reason is water. This is session 263.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGibson.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGimsey and thanks so much for joining me and thank you for your support over the last 10 plus years. We have a terrific show for you today. Brian King, the Executive Vice President of Marketing, Product Management, and Sustainability for Advanced Drainage Systems, provides a tour de force interview on all things stormwater. This is a terrific conversation where you're guaranteed to think differently about stormwater after hearing it. And we also have Reese Tisdale with a Bluefield on Tap segment talking about the potential implications of the 2024 U.S. presidential election on the water sector. So stay tuned. Well, as you know, we always say thank you to our awesome sponsors at the top of every show, and we have some fantastic sponsors. Our sponsorship lineup includes 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, the American Water Works Association, Black & Veatch, 120 Water, and Advanced Drainage Systems. And that is a terrific collection of impactful companies that have affirmatively decided to support water industry thought leadership and education, and I thank you all. And I'd like for you to do me a favor. If you work for or with any of the sponsors, please thank your boss or thank your contact at the sponsor firm and tell them that you appreciate their leadership in the industry through the sponsorship. You'd be surprised how far that simple little note of thanks goes. And as long as you're letting sponsors know that you appreciate their support of water industry education and thought leadership, hey, why not leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast directory you're accessing the podcast on? It'd be greatly appreciated and, of course, helps others find out about the podcast. And also, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Very important. Before we head on to the interview with Brian King, we've got a Bluefield on Tap segment with Bluefield Research's Reese Tisdale addressing the water sector and the 2024 presidential election. So take it away, guys. Reese, welcome back to another Bluefield on Tap segment. How are you this month?
Pretty good, Dave. It is that time of year, so end of summer, moving into fall. But hey, that's the way it goes. So goes life. But lots happening nonetheless.
Yeah, a lot is happening. So what's on your mind this month?
So as we've talked about over the past month or two at Bluefield, we've worked on a white paper. Really the request of clients. They came to us asking, what are the potential implications of the election on the water sector? Is there anything that our team here could point to? And so we had a number of different conversations with clients, workshops, if you will, just to talk through or air out the issues at hand. And as a result, we put together a white paper. So that's really what's happening. It's been actually, I think, fairly well received because I think we did everything we could to keep it sort of down the fairway and straight and narrow, not really choosing sides, hopefully.
Yeah, right. So can you outline at least what kind of the issues your clients were interested in and how you addressed them?
Yeah, I mean, so basically the big question was, what are the impacts? And I think stepping back, I think the playbooks are fairly well established. I mean, that's the advantage of this, at least presidential election. That is, we kind of know what the Harris camp is going to do, and that's really going to be building off of what Biden did, right? It was focusing on things like PFAS, lead service lines, but also within that or under part of that is our disadvantaged communities. That's one aspect impacting the water sector directly. There's a lot happening there. Energy transition, if there's a rub between maybe the two camps, and that would be energy transition, the Biden and or now Harris administration. Expectation is they're going to continue to push renewables away from water-intensive fossil fuels, not because of the water necessarily, but because of the carbon imprint or impact. But also it could push more towards hydrogen, which is very green hydrogen in particular, which is very water intensive. And then another, I think if anything, if the two camps are on the same page, it might be on reshoring, or I guess, you know, reshoring certain industries. They're taking different approaches. And one example of that is water intensive semiconductors. I think both camps agree that that should be, it's a national security issue. Issue for the water sector is many of these facilities being built are in arid or water stress regions. And so therefore that's, those are three areas in particular. The Trump camp is, has a slightly different approach, which has already played out in some ways.
So you mentioned, Trump, the Trump camp. What's your crystal ball say about, the water sector should Trump be elected?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, they've already sort of, their playbook is fairly evident of what they did from 2016 to 2020. And so what we would expect is, you know, Trump obviously is a developer, right? You know, it's in his mindset, and that is, you know, things like the National Environmental Policy Act, right? Permitting. How do we reduce permitting? That's for a long time been a Republican issue at hand. And so how do we either reduce that to accelerate development of certain industries? It could be roads, could be bridges, could be a number of different things. But what does that mean for the water sector? I mentioned the reshoring, bringing industry back. That's the commonality between the two parties, like I said, different approaches to that. And then I would say, lastly, one thing that really has stood out as we were doing this, and that is really more on the legal side of the equation, and that is what happens within the Supreme Court. We've seen some decisions really that are a result of the last Trump administration that have happened more recently over the past couple of years, and that is things like waters of the U.S. and what are the impacts of what are the impacts on EPA's authority and its oversight of certain issues. The other would be Chevron deference. That came out this summer, which is a big part of the white paper. And if anything, it is a push towards giving greater authority to the states and or the judiciary in some cases, taking it away from the executive agencies like the EPA. So that's why if there's an impact, it is probably longer term. Like I said, some of these decisions have played out since 2016 to 2020. You know, it takes the better part of a decade for the Supreme Court cases to roll through the process. And so those are things that could, if Trump becomes president again, then therefore you could see more of that going forward, sort of undercutting the authority of the agencies and pushing it to the states.
Yeah. Very interesting take. Very interesting take. What about the Harris camp? Anything unique or different? You mentioned it might be similar to what the Biden administration is doing, but are there any differences between the Harris platform and what Biden has done?
Well, I think that's a good question, because neither camp, as far as I can tell, even after the conventions, have laid out any policy frameworks. I think the disadvantaged communities obviously is going to play a big role. Anything equity focused or based will play out maybe even a greater role in the Harris camp. And therefore, you know, I would say the Trump administration and or, you know, agency heads that he selects are largely going to be opposed to that. So that is a great divide. You know, one outstanding issue not to be overlooked, and that is what's happening in Congress. We do talk a little bit about in the white paper about the congressional elections, obviously a little bit harder. We're talking about more races happening. But the bigger issue is that Congress is largely ineffectual at this point. It's so tight there's not a lot happening when it comes to policy. It's everything is divided down party lines. It's really tight right now. I think the expectation is if it flips, you know, Senate and, or if the Senate and Congress flips to the Republicans, is it going to be just as tight and equally ineffectual going forward? That's, if there's an issue that I have personally, it would be that. Can we just get some things done for the long term and lay out some policies, whether it be on water quality, whether it be the environment, or whatever it may be.
Got it. Well, Reese, thank you very much for your insights. It's always great to speak with you. You always bring the best. So appreciate it very much. And we'll talk to you next time. Thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Always happy to help.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
As always, great information from Bluefield Research and Reese Tisdale. Now it's time for the main event, our interview with Brian King of Advanced Drainage Systems. So let's get that water flowing. Well, Brian, welcome to the Water Values Podcast. Great to have you on. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for the invitation. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's a topic that I've not hit on a whole lot during the course of the Water Values Podcast, and so I'm excited to talk with you about stormwater today. But before we get to stormwater, can you tell us a little about your background and how you came to the water sector?
Well, I've been in construction or building materials for a while. I won't tell you how long, because that makes me old. But I've been building materials for a while. And 4 years ago, I was recruited to come to Advanced Drainage Systems, who manages stormwater. And that was my introduction to water or the water space. And what was interesting to me about the space is that I think it's an opportunity. I mean, I think it's a space that we manage it. It's there, but nobody really thinks about it. And moving forward, I think we need to think a lot more about stormwater.
Yeah. Personally, I agree. So I am curious from how did you make, what caused you to make the jump from the construction and building materials to ADS, something in the water sector?
I mean, the opportunity at ADS was one for me personally, was to create a product management team to think about how we message what we do to the market and to get after some growth opportunities. I mean, and that's what you look for in a job, right? If you can be in a sector or be in a segment where you have something which is more than just selling a product, more than just, you know, offering a solution, where you're actually and that's why I like construction and building, right? You can see things be made, you can see things be built. And to me, the water space was one where there's a lot of opportunity. There's a lot of focus, or I hope to be a lot more focus as we move forward. And you can actually impact how people live. You can impact quality of life. You can impact sustainability. You can build resilient communities. I mean, to me, when you look at that, you're like, why wouldn't I want to work in that space? And so to me, that was the big opportunity. Then there was the job and they pay me and, you know.
Yeah, that's important. That's important.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm curious, from your seat at ADS, where do you see stormwater fitting into the bigger water picture?
Well, I think when people naturally think of water, they tend to default towards potable or drinking water and wastewater. And what we're, you know, at ADS trying to do is insert stormwater into that conversation, because if you just look at the patterns that are changing within climate, and I was at the IWT show in Toronto last week, and when you walked around the floor and you saw the things that people were talking about, it was all mainly portable drinking water, municipal wastewater. And what's interesting is that if you look at storm activity and what's happening from an intensity perspective, it's definitely changing. And the way that we manage that part of the water cycle, I think it needs to be brought into the conversation.
Right. And so how do you go about doing that?
Well, I mean, I think some of it is just visibility to what's actually going on, right? When you look at 2023, for example, and this was one of the things that I actually talked about when I was up in Toronto, is in 2023 alone, the amount of billion-dollar weather events and climate events was higher than it's ever been. And a lot of that activity is from severe weather, and it's not what you normally think of, right? Everybody thinks about hurricanes, sure. But a lot of it is that high-intensity thunderstorms and that type of activity, which drops a lot of water onto the ground, and then you have to actually manage that and manage it in a way that allows you to do it for the next 50 or 100 years.
Right. And so if I'm a community and I've historically just thought of stormwater as something I just got to get rid of.
Right.
How do you approach it rather than, you know, change the narrative from just the get rid of it to how do you manage it? What have you found to be the best ways to do that?
To be effective? I mean, I still think getting rid of it is important, right? And I don't think it should be overlooked that our ability to get rid of it becomes harder, right, when 50-year storm events happen every 20 years or 10 years. And the amount of rain that falls in a short period of time is higher than we've seen in many, many years. And so I still think that's part of the conversation is, you know, how do you get it from the place that you don't want it to the place that you do want it? And so at ADS, we think about capturing stormwater, conveying it away from where you don't want it to where you want it, storing it, because you can't. I mean, if you get 11 inches of rain in a 24-hour period, you can't just suddenly push that all back to your local lake, river, stream. You're going to have flooding. So you need to store it and then manage it back into the environment. And then finally, the treatment part, which I believe is becoming much more important, when you put it back into the lake, river, or stream or the environment, making sure that it's clean, making sure that you've taken out sediment, you've taken out phosphorus and nitrogen, you've taken out potential heavy metals, you've taken out other contaminants that are in that. I mean, that still needs to be focused on and managed. And then to your point, well, what are other uses of that? On the left side of the country, for example, they have not enough water until they have too much water, and then they have not enough water again. And on the right side of the country, we have a lot of water continuously. And so what do you do with stormwater? Could you use it for irrigation? Could you use it for gray water applications? Could you harvest that rainwater? And to me, it's thinking about the entire stormwater solution and how do you then, you know, again, like I said, insert that into the conversation, manage it today, think about what you're going to do with it in the future. Those are what makes stormwater much more interesting from a concept. It should, I think if you think about it that way, people should be more interested in talking about it.
Absolutely. One man's trash is another man's treasure. And I feel that's how stormwater is kind of viewed. Most people view it as quote trash because they need to get rid of it. But there are opportunities to use it as a resource. I am curious. You identified several, capture, convey, treat. So right. Let's take those kind of in order. When you're capturing, what is that just swales and making sure that we have the infrastructure in place to divert the water to the conveyance infrastructure?
Right. I mean, I think traditionally what people have thought of, right, if you're capturing rainwater is you're capturing it in either, to your point, one of two ways, right? You're either capturing it in hard infrastructure. It's a drain. It's a grate in the ground. It's somewhere that it's going to disappear from your parking lot or your surface area and go underground. Or there's a green aspect to it, right? You're going to have some type of swale which takes it, you know, off your property down to the river that's down the bottom or the pond. And what I would tell you is I think what's changing is it's how do those two things work together, right? So if you're capturing water in an urban environment versus a rural or suburban environment, you may do it differently, right? Because if you're trying to build just a hard infrastructure to capture 100 years worth of stormwater, you're going to end up with a lot of space dedicated to that one event that may happen at some time in the future. And so it's really, I think, as you look at where communities are doing it well, they're thinking about how the green works with the gray or where the environment works with the hard infrastructure. And you think about, you know, building it in such a way that when the 50-year storm happens, you can manage it. But at the same time, it doesn't take up a lot of your community and it gives back to the community from a quality of life perspective. There was an example that I saw recently in New York City where rather than have just a retention pond, they actually built it in such a way that it was a park and the park was built out so that you could enjoy it when there wasn't rain or when there wasn't a 50-year event. But when there was a 50-year event, the areas that they had designed would flood. They would store the stormwater, but they did it in a planned and meaningful way.
It seems like when you're planning for the peak, you can also kind of multi-purpose that area so that it's not only dedicated for the storm event. It has a use during non-storm events. It sounds like it's more efficient use of land and resources.
It's definitely a more efficient loose use of land and resources. And it's also a way to make sure that the community's engaged better. Because, I mean, if you build a giant retention pond, it's out of concrete and you've got a fence around it, generally speaking, that's not an area that people want to spend, you know, their time near. Whereas if you build it into a park or into some areas, LA's got with the LA River Basin, they're starting to do some of those as well, too, as they start to, you know, take the LA River back to being more natural. How do you start to when you do those redevelopment projects, how do you bring the community into it so they enjoy the actual space? And so I think the whole capture piece of it, right, you've got to think about it. Now, convey, generally speaking, happens below ground, right? It can happen in reverse. That's kind of the end stage. But convey happens below ground. And what we're starting to see and what we at ADS are starting to push is the systems that you design have to be designed not for just today, not for solving the immediate need, the flood you had last week or the low-lying ground that has area. You need to think about what is it going to be 50, 100 years. And like I said, you know, climate patterns are changing. The amounts of confirmed storm events last year. In fact, in 2024 alone, there's been 15 weather events already that have exceeded $1 billion in loss. And 13 of them were severe storms. And so, you know, we've got a plan for that changing part of the environment. And that means that communities have to think about not just the initial cost of the project, but what's the ongoing value that they're bringing by managing water.
Got it. So we've talked about capture, a little bit of convey. What about treat?
There's the store part in there, which I'll you know, the third part is our store, which is really just, you know, keeping the water to manage it before you get to that treat side of things. But how you actually store the water, right? And what you do with the water, we would argue that storing the water underground is a better way or better utilization of space. I'll take a commercial example. So you're building a distribution center for an e-commerce company. And you know, land is at a premium. You want to be close to a major center where you're developing that piece of property. The last thing you want to do is have 3 acres, 5 acres of it dedicated to a retention pond for a variety of different reasons, right? But let's pick on the one, which is that's a bunch of space I can't park trucks on, or I can't have a building on top of because it's got to be a pond. If you put that underground, then you can park your trucks on top of it. It can be underneath your parking lot. And so where you store the water and thinking about when the rain happens or the rain or storm event happens, planning your property or your space, we think there's a really good argument to be made that should be stored underground because it gives you more utilization or space utilization. At the same time, it also takes away a safety factor. You know, having a retention pond is great, but things fall into retention ponds and things can happen. There's wildlife that you may or may not want living in that retention pond. There's potentially stagnant water, right? There's a lot of things you have to think about if you have a large pond. And so that's our store piece.
Yeah.
So, and then we get to treatment.
Yeah. So, but before we get on to treatment, can you talk a little about what's involved in underground stormwater storage?
So, we have a product we call StormTech. Essentially, it looks like a chamber underground. If you've ever, you know, if you ever, the example I like to use, if you've ever been to the catacombs in Paris, it's similar, a giant arch under the ground. And what you have to think about is the amount of dollars you spend per cubic foot of storage. That's basically what most developers will look for is, you know, I have to store X amount of water, right? They do all the calculations based on square footage of the roof and square footage of the parking lot. And you say, if I have a storm event where 3 inches of rain fall, I have to capture, you know, X amount of, you know, acre feet of water. And then we do the math, which is you have to then determine how much storage space you need underground. And the determining factor is the dollars per cubic foot of storage. And we have some very large chambers that we make. In fact, our largest chamber that we make stands about 6 feet high, 6 feet wide, and about 6 feet long. And you essentially dig a hole, you put the chamber in there, you wrap it with geotextiles, you put some stone down there, and it becomes an area underground where you can store that water. That's the basic, you know, how do you get there? And then there's a variety of different solutions. Obviously, I would tell you that our StormTech chamber is a great way to do that, but there's other ways with some other products that exist to do that, including pipe and stone and concrete. Are all options depending on what you're doing or how load bearing it is.
Got it. And I assume that those chambers are modular, so you can put multiple chambers in, and depending on how much storage space you anticipate needing.
Exactly right. I mean, we have small ones, we have big ones, we have, you know, everything in between. There's about eight sizes in the product line. I gave you the description of the biggest one, but there's small ones as well too. And then it depends on water table. Obviously, it depends on where you are, what the load is that you want to put above it, what your site and the solution that you can put into the site. Sometimes you have to go deeper, right? Sometimes you can go wider based on space. And so there's a lot of engineering considerations that are brought into that. What I would tell you that we do well at ADS is we have a team of engineers that help work with the engineering firm that the developer has put on board, and the developers sometimes to come up with systems which, say, for example, you're building. There's a lot of Sheetz gas stations being built around here. If you're going to continue to build a Sheetz gas station, they do it in a modular function. We can provide to them a solution which, you know, allows them to build that property, develop that property a lot faster.
Yeah. And so what typically gets put above these? Is it just parking facilities? Have you ever
It tends to be green space and or parking. I mean, to put load above these, you can do it. There's probably a product out there, you know, you probably use, if you're going to be under a load bearing structure, if there's going to be a building above it, probably using something like concrete is better for that type of application. I would tell you what we like to do at ADS is make sure that we're part of a system which meets the needs of the customer. And so we definitely have products that we think are the right product for applications, but depending on the situation, we know sometimes that our product's not the right product for the solution.
Got it. All right. So I think we've hit storage. So let's go on to that next step of treatment.
Right. So let's talk about treatment. So treatment is really the last step in that, which is how do you release that product or the water back into the environment? And it's at this stage where water harvesting starts to become part of the conversation. And I would tell you, we should probably talk about that later, but water harvesting or rainwater harvesting is pretty new. There's not a lot of people thinking about that. But back to treatment. What you have to think about is when you put the water back into the environment, especially if you're on the coasts, especially if you're in a sensitive area like the Chesapeake Bay, or you're in the Bay Area of California, or even over the Edwards Aquifer in Texas, is what's the quality of the water that you're putting back into the environment? And so a series of different treatment solutions we have hydrodynamic separators, which is essentially a whirlpool, which separates out the sediment from within that water. You can then take it through some filtration units, a variety of different ways and technologies to do that. But essentially what you're looking at is taking out phosphorus, taking out heavy metals, and making sure that you're meeting the codes and standards which are within your area. And that, David's a really interesting thing because codes and standards across the U.S. are not consistent.
Yeah, I've seen patchwork regulation before, so I'm kind of curious: is there a move towards standardization of those codes and regulations? I mean, is there what?
There's two sort of, you know, big governing code bodies or standards that people go with. One is NJCAT, which is the New Jersey, has some regulations and standards. And the other is the Washington DOE. And so depending on which state you are, and it's not all the states on the left side of the country on the west are Washington DOE, and all the ones on the right are NJCAT. But those are the two big certifications that if you're going to sell a water quality product in the stormwater space, you need to meet. And then there are some other regional things as well. I would tell you, I think it's moving more towards standardization. It's moving more towards making sure that everybody is trying to do the same thing. But there's certain parts of the country. I mean, Florida is currently going through some rules and some rule setting. And so, you know, we may have something unique in Florida that may be a continuation or based on one of those, but I think it's getting better, but there's definitely lots of opportunity in that space.
You identified Washington and New Jersey, obviously.
Right.
Do the differing nature of the climates in both as you've indicated, the left half and the right half of the country, do those merit different standards, or do you think there's a uniform standard that could be applicable throughout the entire country?
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be some regional uniqueness. I mean, what we like to think of when we think of our business is we're a national company and we offer solutions all across the U.S., but we're also a very local local business because there's local rules and regulations. There's local approvals and acceptance of products. And so I would tell you, I think there's when you get to the quality of water, right, there's, you know, if you're going to return water to a watershed, there is a general standard that you would hope that we could meet. And so I think there is the general standards. The question is, how do you get there? How do you test for it? And how comfortable are the different governing bodies in their approach to that? So I think ultimately, if you said, does everybody want clean water? We'd all agree. Check. Do you want it as it comes out of stormwater? Would you prefer stormwater to go back into the environment in a better condition in which it landed on the property and didn't pick up pollutants and potential contaminants? I think, again, everybody would answer yes. And then you get into the, you know, the tactical piece of, well, how do we get after it? How do we answer that? And is there something unique to the Great Lakes versus the Chesapeake Bay versus the Edwards Aquifer? That's when the regional differences come into play.
Great. Interesting take. So you talked about harvesting. I'm obviously, you know, lots of people are obviously familiar with rain barrels. It seems to me that there may be different grades of how contaminated water gets. If it's a rain barrel, low contamination. If it's coming off a street with that's going to pick up heavy metals and oil and things like that, it may have a different treatment characteristics. Can you talk a little about the harvesting process? Sure.
And you're right. I mean, it definitely depends on what the source of the water is, right? Both from a treatment perspective, the level of treatment that you actually have to do, and then where the source of the water is. And, you know, one of the things we say is, you know, if the water comes off the roof of a building, generally speaking, it's cleaner than if it comes off a parking lot. And so how you treat those and how you look after those and what you have to remove from it is definitely part of the puzzle. Rainwater, generally speaking, I mean, what people are looking to do with it is, you know, number one, if I don't have to treat it too much, what can I do? Can I water my plants or can I use it for irrigation? I mean, that's where we're starting to see some movement, especially in bigger projects. Like if you have you're building a huge stadium, for example, and it's got a lot of roof space and you're going to collect a lot of water, and then you have grass within that stadium to play the sport on, it naturally seems like that would be an opportunity, both economically and environmentally, a good opportunity for you to be able to reuse that. Similarly, you know, could you use the water that you flush toilets with or gray water? Can you use stormwater to do that? And then if you go even further, say you're a bottling plant and you're making a drink, you capture water on the roof. Could you theoretically get it back to the point where you could use that water as part of your process water? There's examples of all of those across the U.S., but like I said, a lot of it is driven not necessarily by code or regulation. A lot more of it is driven by the desire of the building owner and the operator to be able to make a commitment back to sustainability or a commitment back to, you know, just having a better operation. Because most of the times what we find is sustainability ties to better economic value. And I think that's really interesting in the water space, is that you can be sustainable and at the same time, the sustainability activities that you have, because it's involving water, actually are, you know, economically better, which I think is pretty unique for the water space. It makes me excited for sure.
Well, as you were talking really at the beginning of the episode, when you talked about the retention pond and you don't want a couple acres of retention pond, I was in my mind, if you can bury the stormwater, that allows for greater densities, which it impacts the run of wastewater, you know, sewer infrastructure, water infrastructure, electric infrastructure, thermal networks, to the extent those are used. I think you can create an entirely more efficient and sustainable development by using the techniques you laid out there.
Absolutely. I think you can think about designing, you know, communities where the quality of life, or what you're thinking about from a quality of life perspective, like you said, you know, the ability to walk around and not have to go over bridges or think about bridges or infrastructure because you've got some stuff underground. And I think sustainability and being more, you know, not just what the impact is, which we just talked about, but the actual thinking about the products you're using as well too. And one of the things that not a lot of people know about ADS is that we are one of the largest plastics recyclers in the U.S. In fact, last year, 550 million pounds of plastic was used that was kept out of a landfill. And it was taken from a single use plastic. Generally, it's a milk jug or a detergent bottle. And we turn it into a plastic pipe. And the plastic pipe goes into the ground and has a service life of up to 100 years. So it takes it out of the waste stream for 100 years. And then theoretically, we haven't been around for 100 years yet. We've only been around for 65. But theoretically, at the end of the product's life, you could take that pipe out of the ground. You could clean it off. You could grind it up. And then you could use that back in our process to make more pipe.
Phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal.
I think it's pretty exciting. And I think it's a story which we're starting to tell more of. I mean, not only does the pipe manage water, it's inert. There's no there's no contaminants that come out of the actual pipe itself. It's HDPE or high density polyethylene. We can take waste out of the stream to make that product. And one of the challenges we have, I mean, we talked a little bit about regulations, is that, believe it or not, in certain parts of the U.S., you're not allowed to use recycled product in infrastructure.
Wow.
So there is an opportunity, I think, for us to be able to push that code, to be able to show that you can use recycled goods. In fact, NIST just came out with a report which says a great use for recycled products is in infrastructure construction. And they used pipe as an example of where if you could use recycled HDPE pipe, it's better for the environment from a waste perspective. It also has less greenhouse gas emissions because you're using a recycled product as opposed to virgin. And you end up with a product which has, you know, again, less greenhouse gas emissions. Seems like there's a win there, right?
There's a couple of them. Well, Brian, you've been absolutely fantastic today. I really appreciate you spending some time with me. I've learned a lot, you gave me some great ideas. So I really thank you for that. Do you have a leave behind message?
I think the leave behind message is that at ADS, we think about our reason, and our reason is water. And we're obviously focused very much in the stormwater space. We also have a business, the infiltrator business, that does decentralized wastewater or septic systems, which at some point, if you want to talk to some of our team about septic and that, I think that's a very fascinating category as well too. But really the message is that stormwater is as important as potable water and wastewater. And it is the third leg of the water stool. And all three of those things work together. And with changing environment, you know, with growing populations, with people wanting access to clean drinking water and water to enjoy, frankly, stormwater needs to be thought of as part of that narrative and part of that conversation.
Well said. Well said. So for those who want to find out more about you, more about ADS and their products, where can they go to get that information?
So our website's probably the best place to go. It's adspipe.com. Or you can search for us on the Google machine under advanced drainage systems. And I think we've got some pretty good, the marketing team I work with does some really great work. So you'll find all sorts of places to go around sustainability, resiliency, actual products, how we think about water and stormwater. And so I would encourage people as that's the first place to start. And then we have a team of professionals across the U.S. that work with engineers, they work with developers, and we're always happy to talk about stormwater management and our solutions.
Awesome. Well, Brian, again, thank you so much for coming on. Great speaking with you, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks so much.
Sounds great, and I appreciate the invitation. Thank you very much.
You bet. Bye, Brian.
Bye.
Absolutely fantastic interview by Brian. I loved his point about the more efficient use of land and resources by storing stormwater underground. It just makes so much sense, and I'm not sure why we haven't done that more previously. Would love to know what you thought about the interview. Please check out the show notes page for information and links on this episode. Just Google the Water Values Podcast and click the first link that comes up. That'll take you to the landing page at our home on the Bluefield Research website. Again, Bluefield Research and the Water Values LLC are not affiliate entities. We just have a joint marketing arrangement. And as part of that, Bluefield Research gives us a home on the web. You can email me at david.mcgimsey@dentons.com, and you can sign up for the newsletter at that landing page I mentioned earlier as well. Well, thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you make it a great day. Plus, I want to give a huge thank you to our sponsors. Again, the sponsors of the Water Values Podcast include 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, the American Water Works Association, Black & Veatch, 120 Water, and Advanced Drainage Systems. This show would not be possible without those great companies and industry leaders. And again, thank you for listening and for subscribing to the Water Values Podcast. Your support is truly appreciated. In closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
Listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Well, thank you for tuning in to the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and nothing in this podcast should be taken as providing legal advice or as establishing an attorney-client relationship with you or with anyone else. Additionally, nothing in this podcast should be considered a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer that finds water issues interesting and that believes greater public education is needed about water issues. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues because no one knows everything about water.